believed the croc held olives. They were lovely. The olives went to tree. They looked a little lonely on their shelf, but lonely was a long sight better than naught but empty echo, salt, and butter full of knives. Better by a long road. Next she checked on things in port. The ice blue bottle wasn't entirely at home. It huddled on the lowest leftist shelf upon the eastern wall. Ari touched it gently, doing her best to reassure. He liked bottles. Might this be a seemly gift? She picked it up and turned it in her hands. But no, not this bottle. Grave, graven, not named for someone else. Maybe some other bottle? That felt nearly right. Not quite, but nearly. She thought about the vanity and tumbrel. Yesterday it had seemed squared and true, but she was more than slightly tattered then, not at her best. Perhaps there was a bottle mixed among the rest, something wrong or lost or out of place. If nothing else, it was a place to start. So Ari gathered up the warm, sweet weight of fulcrum in her arms. And because he hadn't seen them yet, she took the slightly longer way through Van and Forth and Lucient before she headed down to Wayne's. She paused to rest in Annulet, her new and perfect circle of a sitting room. Fulcrum settled like a king upon the velvet chair while Ari lounged upon the fainting couch and let her arms recover from the oh-sweet ache of holding him. But she was too busy for long lounging, so Ari gathered up the heavy gear again and made her slow way up the unnamed stair, taking her time so Fulcrum could marvel at the odd and cunning coyness of the place. And, as the two of them were gentlefolk, they both ignored the bashful door that sat upon the landing. Then into Tumbrel. Climbing through the wall, Ari saw the room was just as she remembered. Not perfect true, like Annulet, but nothing glaringly unskew, nothing askant or lost or loudly wrong. Now that the vanity was squared away, Tumbrel seemed content to rumble down into a long, warm winter's sleep. Even so, she'd come all this way. So she opened up the wardrobe and peered inside. She touched the chamber pot. She looked into the closet, too, nodding politely to the broom and bucket there. Ari eyed the vanity. There were a few fine bottles there. One especially caught her eye. It was small and pale, coruscant like opal, perfect with a cunning clasp. She didn't have to open it to see that there was breath inside. A precious thing. She lifted Fulcrum higher and tried peering through the round hole in the very center of his oh-so-centeredness. She hoped to notice something she had missed before, something loose or raveldy, some thread that she could tug to jostle something free. But no. Whether she looked straight or slant, the vanity was well and truly set to rights. A bottle coruscant with hidden breath would be a princely gift. But no, taking it was every bit as stupid and unkind as wrenching out a tooth so she could carve a bead from it and thread it on a string. She sighed and left, out through the wall, then down the unnamed stair. Perhaps she could go hunting down in Lynn. It was a piping place, and it was then. Heading down, a sly stone turned beneath her foot. As Ari made her musing way from Tumbrel down the unnamed stair, a stone step tipped and pitched, her forward, lurching. Ari gave a cry, and in her sudden startle, Fulcrum leapt away. He spun and tumbled from her arms and sailed out from the cloud of her gold hair. Heavy as he was, he almost seemed to float rather than fall. He turned, toppled, and struck the seventh stair so hard he cracked the stone, and bounded back into the air, then spun again, fell flat upon his brazen face, and shattered on the landing. The sound he made was like the keening of a broken bell. The sound was like a dying harp. Bright pieces scattered when he struck the stone. Ari somehow kept her feet. She didn't fall, but oh, her heart went icy in her chest. She sat down hard upon the steps, too numb to walk. Her heart was cold and white as chalk. She could still feel him in her hands. She saw the lines of his sharp edges kissed into her skin. Coming to her feet, she shuffled stiffly down the stairs. Her steps were numb and stumbling, as more thoughtless stepstones tried to trip her, like a daft old man who won't stop telling an unfunny joke yet and again. She knew she should have moved more gently with the world. She knew the way of things. She knew if you weren't always stepping lightly as a bird, the whole world came apart to crush you, like a house of cards, like a bottle against stones, like a wrist pinned hard beneath a hand with the hot breath smell of want and wine. All brittle stiff, Ari came to stand upon the bottom stair. Her eyes were down, and all around her hung her sunny hair. This was the worst of wrong. She could not bring herself to look beyond her tiny, dust-smudged feet. But there was nothing else to do. She lifted up her eyes and peered, then peeked. Then she saw the pieces, and her heart went sideways in her chest. No, not shattered, broken. He had broken. Slowly Ari's face broke too. It broke into a grin so wide you'd think she ate the moon. Oh, yes, Fulcrum had broken, but that wasn't wrong. Eggs break, horses break, waves break. Of course he broke. How else could someone so all-certain-centered let his perfect answers out into the world? Some things were just too true to stay. Fulcrum lay in three bright pieces, three jagged shapes with three teeth each. No longer a pin stuck hard into the heart of things, he had become three threes. If anything, her grin grew wider then. Oh, of course, it wasn't something she was looking for. No wonder all her searching was for naught. No wonder everything was canted wrong. It was three things. He was bringing three, and so must she. Three perfect threes would be her gift for him. Ari's brow furrowed, and she turned to look back up the stairs. The gear had struck the seventh step. Fulcrum had shattered it quite flagrantly. Not seven, then. Another thing she had been wrong about. He wasn't coming on the seventh day. He would visit her today. Some other time that knowing might have sent her spinning badly out of true. It would have set her all a-sweat and tangled beyond all hope. But not today. Not with the truth so sweetly set before her. Not with everything so sudden plain for her to see. Three things was easy if you knew the way of it. Ari was so whelmed it took her several minutes before she realized where she was standing. Or rather, she realized that the stairway finally knew where it was, knew what it was, where it belonged. It had a name. She was in Ninewise. The Hidden Heart of Things. Ari gathered up the threes and headed back to Mantle. They seemed much lighter now, though that was no surprise. They had spilled their secrets, and Ari knew full well how heavy hard-held secrets could become. Back in Mantle, Ari carefully arrayed the threes. But before she even finished settling them against the wall, she saw the shape of her first gift to him. It couldn't be more clear. No wonder there was so much extra floor in here. No wonder she had never used the second shelf along the wall. The teeth were marvelous, so true, they shone like wishes from a fairy tale. Seeing how it ought to be, Ari took the first bright three straight back to Tumbril, through Wayne's with its all-together men, and circle-perfect annulet, then Ninewise, all nonchalant with its new namedness. Grinning, Ari carried the bright brass three right up to the wardrobe drawer and tucked it in most carefully. It nestled in effortlessly. It fit there like a lover or a key. She reached down with both hands and felt the cool white smoothness of the sheet against her fingertips. She brought it up and pressed it to her lips. It was free to leave, and breathless, she came running back to Mantle with it clutched against her chest. The second three she carried straight away to Tox, and for a breathless moment Ari left the underthing behind, a broken wall, a hidden stair, then through a basement up into the storeroom of the finest inn she knew. There she left the three and took away a thick white eider stuffed with innocence and down. It was fine and soft, full of kind whispers and remembered roads. Even laden with the weight of it, Ari sprinted through the tunnels lightly as a wisp. Back in Mantle, she spread the mattress carefully against the wall across from her own bed, close enough that if needed, her just whispering would be enough. Close enough so if he wanted to, he could sing to her at night. She flushed a bit on thinking that, then brought the perfect creamy sheet and wrapped it all around his bed. She smoothed it gently with her hands. Its loveliness was like a kiss against her skin. Grinning, Ari crossed to port and brought the blanket back. No wonder it had left her. It had known the truth of things much sooner than herself. It simply wasn't for her anymore. She spread his blanket on the bed and noticed it no longer feared the floor. Stepping back, she looked at it, so soft and sweet and safe and fair. From port she brought his fine teacup. She brought the leather book, uncut, unread, and utterly unknown. She brought the small stone figurine. All three of these she set upon the shelf beside his bed so he would have some beauty of his own. And just like that, she had a gift for him, a safe place he could stay. As much as she might want to stop and bask, she needed to keep moving. Three was the rule today. She needed two gifts more. Ari went back to port and eyed the shelves with her best maker's eye. And since it was a making day, and with the wind so fair upon her back, she thought on what it was that he might need. It was a different way of thinking. Even though she was not wanting for herself, she knew this sort of thing was dangerous. She eyed the holly bottle. It teased at her, but she knew it wasn't right for him. Not quite. It was an unexpected visit gift. The honeycomb, almost. She reached out to touch two fingers to the jar of laurel fruit. She lifted up the jar and held it to the light. It's true that he was somewhat lacking laurels. It clicked together then. Of course. She smiled a bit. What better to keep rage at bay? Besides, it was the third part of a thing she'd already begun, a candle. A candle would be just the thing for him. She stopped then, all of a sudden, the jar still in her hand. She held her breath and thought about the hard realities of time. A candle meant melting, and melding, and most of all it meant a mold. She felt her whole face frowning at the thought of something dipped for him. It wasn't right at all. He was not one for dribs and drabs. No, a mold. It was the only way to make a candle fine enough for him. And that meant boundary. She didn't hardly hesitate at all. For herself, she would not dare. But this was simply how it had to be. Didn't he deserve a few fine things? After all that he had done, didn't he deserve a fine and princely gift? Of course he did. So Ari strode to Mantle. So Ari opened wide the iron-bound door. So Ari entered Boundary. It was a clean and quiet place. There was a workbench. It was dark and smooth and hard as stone. There were mountings on the sides, a vise, a set of floating rings, a burner stand. There were taps and faucets well arrayed, all steel and brass and iron. There were shelves here, all mounted on one wall, crowded with vast and varied tools of the craft, acids and reagents in their stoppered glasses, sulfonium inside a jar of stone. racks of powders, salts and earths and herbs, oils and unguents. 14 waters, twice lime, camphor, all perfect, all true, all gathered and factored and stored in the most proper ways. There were tools here, alembics and retorts, a fine wide wickless burner, coils of copper tubing, crucibles and tongs and boiling baths. There were sieves and filters and copper knives. There was a fine grinder and a gleaming clean screw press. There were the stone shelves, too, the careful shelves. Bottles hunkered there behind the thick, thick glass. These bottles were not tidy like the other shelves. They were not labeled. They were muttly. One held Screaming, another Fury. There were many bottles there, and those two were nowhere near the worst. Ari set the jar of laurel fruit atop the workbench. She was a small thing, urchin small. Most things did not fit her. Most tables were too tall. This one was not. This room used to belong to her, but no. This room belonged to someone once. Now it didn't. It wasn't. It was a none place. It was an empty sheet of nothing that could not belong. It was not for her. Ari opened a drawer in the workbench and brought out a rectangular brass mold, the sort that would suit a candle well. Her expression grave, Ari eyed the laurel fruit. It was every bit as reverent as one might expect, but it was prideful too, and held a hint of North Wind's chill. That needed to be tempered. And, yes, there was a thread of anger running through it, too. She sighed. That would not do at all. She narrowed her eyes at it and danced the numbers through her head. Glancing back and forth between the mold and the jar of fruit, she saw the wax it bore would not be near enough, not for an entire candle. Not for a proper candle, not for him. Ari left and returned with the honeycomb. Moving in a businesslike fashion, she lay it in the press and screwed the handle down until the honey poured into the clear, clean jar below. It was the work of half a minute. Leaving it to drip, she lit the nearby wickless and spun the ring stand so that it held a crucible at the proper height. She opened up the press, lifted out the flat sheet of beeswax, and folded it in quarters before setting it in the crucible. There was not a lot of it, perhaps as much as she could cup in both her hands. But once she'd rendered down the laurel fruit, it would be enough to fill the mold. Ari eyed the melting wax and nodded. It was a drowsy thing, all autumn sweetness, diligence, and due reward. The bells were not unwelcome either. There was nothing in it that she did not want for him. Honey and laurel might have been enough if this were a simple poet's candle, but he was no mere poet. She needed something more. A pinch of camphor would have been ideal, just a pinch, a spark, a hint of something volatile. But she had no camphor, and there was no sense in wishing. So she fetched a daub of perfect pitch instead from port. For binding and to keep his heart hardy against the coming winter. Ari stirred the beeswax with a slender glass rod. She smiled. It was a rare joy working with the proper tools. What luxury! Waiting for the resin to dissolve, Ari whistled as she stirred and grinned. That would be her secret. There would be her whistle in the candle, too. She stepped into mantle then, and eyed her perfect lavender in the gray glass jar. She lifted out a sprig of it, then two, then Ari felt the hot shame rise in her chest. This was no time for thrift. He was never stingy with his help. Didn't he deserve sweet dreams? Ari set her jaw and pulled fully half the lavender from out the jar. She could be a greedy, greedy thing at times. Back into Boundary, Ari poured the laurel fruit into the grinder. In 3 breaths' time, it was minced tidily and fine. Then she stopped, staring at the mass of half-pulped fruit. She knew the proper way for laurel. She knew the patient way of things. Grind and boil the waxy fruit, sieve off the dottle, boil again and clarify and cool to separate the wax. Even with the proper tools, it would be hours of work, hours and hours. But he was coming soon. She knew she had no time for it. And even if she had all day, there would be principles inside the wax that were not right for him. He was plumb full of anger and despair and pride. Well, he had that in a sure and certain surfeit. There were ways to factor those things out. She knew them all. She knew the turning circles of the calcinate. She could sublime and draw. She could isolate a non-exclusionary principle as well as any who had ever turned their hand to work the craft. But this was not a time for begging favors from the moon. Not now. She could not rush, and neither could she be delayed. Some things were simply too important. It was just as Mandrag said. 9/10 of alchemy was chemistry, and 9/10 of chemistry was waiting. The other piece? That slender 10th part of a 10th? The heart of alchemy was something Ari had learned long ago. She'd studied it before she came to understand the true shape of the world, before she knew the key to being small. Oh, yes, she'd learned her craft. She knew its hidden roads and secrets, all the subtle, sweet, and coaxing ways that made one skilled within the art. So many different ways. Some folk inscribed, described. There were symbols, signifiers, bind and binding, formulae, machineries of maths. But now she knew much more than that. So much of what she'd thought was truth before was merely tricks, no more than clever ways of speaking to the world. They were a bargaining, a plea, a call, a cry. But underneath there was a secret deep within the hidden heart of things. Mandrag never told her that. She did not think he knew. Ari found that secret for herself. She knew the true shape of the world. All else was shadow and the sound of distant drums. Ari nodded to herself. Her tiny face was grave. She scooped the waxy fine ground fruit into a sieve and set the sieve atop a gather jar. She closed her eyes. She drew her shoulders back. She took a slow and steady breath. There was a tension in the air. A weight. A weight. There was no wind. She did not speak. The world grew stretched and tight. Ari drew a breath and opened up her eyes. Ari was urchin small. Her tiny feet upon the stone were bare. Ari stood, and in the circle of her golden hair she grinned and brought the weight of her desire down full upon the world. And all things shook, and all things knew her will, and all things bent to please her. It was not long before Ari returned to Mantle with a sorrel-colored candle pressed with lavender. It smelled of bay and bees. It was a perfect thing. Ari washed her face. She washed her hands and feet. Soon, she knew, soon he would come visiting, incarnadine and sweet and sad and broken, just like her. He would come, and like the proper gentleman he was, he would bring three things. Grinning, Ari fairly danced. She would have three things for him as well. First, his clever candle, all Tabberlin, all warm and stuffed with poetry and dreams. Second was a proper place, a shelf where he could put his heart, a bed to sleep. Nothing could harm him here. And the third thing? Well, she ducked her face and felt a slow flush climb her cheeks. Stalling, Ari reached out for the small stone soldier sitting on his bedshelf. Strange she'd never noticed the design upon its shield. It was so faint. But yes, there was the tower wrapped up in a tongue of flame. No mere soldier, It was a small stone emir. Peering closer, Ari spied slight lines upon his arms as well. She did not know how she had missed these things before. It was a tiny Cyridae. Of course it was. It would hardly be a proper present for him otherwise. She kissed the tiny figurine and set it back upon the shelf. Still, there was the third thing. This time Ari did not blush. She smiled. She washed her face and hands and feet. Then she skipped quickly into port and opened up the holly bottle. With two fingers, Ari lifted out a single seed, the tiny berry bright as blood despite green foxen's light. Ari scampered off to Van and peered into the mirror. She licked her lips and pressed the berry up against them, daubing it from left to right. Then she smoothed the berry back and forth across them. She eyed her reflection. She looked no different than before. Her lips were palest pink. She smiled. Ari returned to Mantle. She washed her face and hands and feet. Excitement bubbling up inside of her, Ari looked at his bed, his blanket, his bedshelf with the tiny emir waiting there to guard him. It was perfect. It was right. It was a start. He would need a place someday, and it was here all ready for him. Someday he would come, and she would tend to him. Someday he would be the one, all eggshell, hollow, empty in the dark. And then, Ari smiled. Not for herself, no. Not ever for herself. She must stay small and tucked away, well hidden from the world. But for him it was a different thing entire. For him she would bring forth all her desire. She would call up all her cunning and her craft. Then she would make a name for him. Ari spun about three times. She smelled the air. She grinned. All around her everything was proper true. She knew exactly where she was. She was exactly where she ought to be. Coda. Deep in the underthing, stones warm beneath her feet, Ari heard a faint, sweet strain of music. Endnote. Let me tell you a story about a story, because that's what I do. Back in January of 2013, I was in a San Francisco bar with Vi Hart, math musician, video tricks, and all-around lovely person. We'd both been fans of each other's work for years without knowing it, and had recently been introduced by a mutual friend. This was our first time meeting in person. I had just finished the first draft of this story, and Vi had agreed to take a look at it and give me her opinion. We spent a couple hours talking about the story, our conversation frequently tangenting off in odd directions, the way good conversations do. Her feedback was really good, not just clever, but startlingly insightful. When I mentioned this to her, she looked slightly amused and explained that writing was most of what she did. She scripted her videos, then recorded them. The scripting was the lion's share of the work. She pointed out some things that needed work in the story, some rough spots, some logical incongruities. She pointed out the parts she liked, too, and talked about the story as a whole. I should mention that by this point in the evening, I was slightly drunk. A bit of a rarity for me, but since we were hanging out in a bar, it seemed polite to buy a drink. Then I had a drink because Vi was having another, and I wanted to be social. Then I had another because I was a little nervous about meeting Vi for the first time. And then I had another because I was a little nervous about my story. Well, let's be honest. I was more than a little nervous about the story. I knew, deep down in my heart of hearts, that my new wrought story was a train wreck, a colossal smoldering mess of a train wreck. "It doesn't do the things a story is supposed to do," I said to her. "A story should have dialogue, action, conflict. A story should have more than one character. I've written a 30,000-word vignette." Vi said she liked it. "Well, yes," I said, "I like it too, but that doesn't matter. You see, people expect certain things from a story," I explained. You can leave out one or two if you step carefully, but you can't ditch all of them. The closest thing I have to an action scene is someone making soap. I spend 8 pages describing someone making soap. 8 pages of a 60-page story making soap. That's something a crazy person does. As I've said, I was really worried about the story, and perhaps more than slightly drunk. And I was finally getting something off my chest that I hadn't really shared with anyone before. "People are going to read this and be pissed," I said. Vi looked at me with serious eyes. I felt more of an emotional connection to the inanimate objects in this story than I usually feel towards entire characters in other books, she explained. "It's a good story." But I wasn't having any of it. I shook my head, not even looking up at her. "Readers expect certain things. People are going to read this and be disappointed. It doesn't do what a normal story is supposed to do." Then Vi said something I will always remember. "Fuck those people," she said. "Those people have stories written for them all the time. What about me? Where's the story for people like me?" Her voice was passionate and hard and slightly angry. She might have slammed her hand down on the table at this point. I like to think she slammed her hand down on the table. Let's say she did. "Let those other people have their normal stories," Vi said. "This story isn't for them. This is my story. This story is for people like me." It was one of the nicest things that anyone has ever said to me. I did not mean to write this story. Or rather, I did not mean to have this story about Ari turn out the way that it did. I started writing it midway through 2012. I meant for it to be a short story for the Rogues anthology, edited by George Martin and Gardner Dojois. I'd anticipated it being a trickster story, and figured Ari would make a nice complement to the more traditional scoundrel-type rogues who would no doubt show up in that book. But the story didn't turn out the way that I'd expected. It was stranger than a simple trickster tale, and Ari herself was more full of secrets and mysteries than I had guessed. Eventually, the Ari story hit 14,000 words, and I abandoned it. It was too long, too odd. And beside all that, it had become clear that it wasn't right for the anthology. Ari was no mere trickster. More importantly, this wasn't a rogue story at all. Despite the fact that I was already over deadline, Martin and Gardner were very kind and gave me some extra time. So I wrote The Lightning Tree instead, a story featuring Bast, a much better fit for the anthology. But Ari's story was still crawling around in my head, and I realized the only way to get it out was to finish the thing. Besides, I owed Bill Schaefer at Subterranean Press a novella from way back. He'd published my 2 not-for-children picture books, The Adventures of the Princess and Mr. Whiffle, The Thing Beneath the Bed, and the sequel, The Dark of Deep Below. So I knew he wasn't afraid of a story that was a little strange. So I kept writing the story, and it kept on getting longer and stranger. I could tell by this point that it wasn't any sort of normal. It wasn't doing the things a proper sort of story should do. It was, by all traditional metrics, a mess. But here's the thing. I liked it. It was weird and wrong and tangled and missing so many things that a story is supposed to need, but it kind of worked. Not only was I learning a lot about Ari and the Underthing, but the story itself had a sort of sweetness to it. Whatever reason, I let the story develop according to its own desire. I didn't force it into a different shape or put anything into it just because it was supposed to be there. I decided to let it be itself, at least for now, at least until I made it to the end. Then I knew I'd probably have to wield the editorial hatchet, performing cruel surgery in order to turn it into something normal. But not yet. You see, I'd actually been down this road before. The Name of the Wind does a lot of things it's not supposed to. The prologue is a laundry list of things that you should never do as a writer. But despite all that, it works. Sometimes a story works because it's different. Maybe this was that kind of story. But when I wrote the 8-page scene with Ari making soap, I realized that was not the case. I was writing a trunk story. For those of you that don't know the term, a trunk story is something you write, then when it's finished, you put the manuscript in the bottom of a trunk and forget about it. It's not the sort of story that you can sell to a publisher, not the sort of story that people want to read. It's the sort of story that you write, then on your deathbed you remember it and ask a close friend to burn all your unpublished papers, right after they clear your browser history, of course. I knew Bill at Sub Press was delightfully open to strange projects, but this? No. No, this was a story I had to write to get out of my head. I had to write it to learn about Ari and the world, which is named Temerant, by the way. Did you catch that? Simply said, I knew this story was for me. It wasn't for other people. Sometimes that happens. But still, I liked it. It was strange and sweet. I'd finally found Ari's voice. I'm rather fond of her. And I'd learned a lot about writing in the third person, so it wasn't a total waste of time. When it was finished, I sent it to my agent, Matt, because that's what you're supposed to do when you're a writer. I told him I was going to offer it to Bill, but that I didn't expect Bill would actually want it, as it was, narratively speaking, a train wreck. But Matt read it and liked it. He gave me a call and said that we should send it to Betsy, my editor at Daw. She isn't going to want this, I said. It's a mess. It's the story a crazy person writes. Matt reminded me that, according to my contracts, Betsy had right of first refusal on any future books I wrote. Besides, he said, it's just polite to loop her in. She's your primary publisher. I shrugged and told him to go ahead and send it, slightly embarrassed to think of Betsy reading it. But then Betsy read it and liked it. She really liked it. She wanted to publish it. That's when I started to sweat. In the many months since my conversation with Vi Hart, I've revised this story roughly 80 times. This isn't unusual for me. In fact, it's a little on the light side. As part of this process, I've given this story to about 36 beta readers, gathering feedback to help me in my endless obsessive revisions. And one comment people have made over and over, again and again, phrased many different ways, is this. I don't know what other people will think. They probably won't like it. But I really enjoyed it. It's strange to me how many people have said some version of that. Hell, I just now realize that I said something similar myself earlier in this author's note. The truth is, I'm fond of Ari. I have a special place in my heart for this strange, sweet, shattered girl. I love her more than just a little. I think it's because we're both somewhat broken in our own odd ways. More importantly, we're both aware of it. Ari knows she isn't all quite proper true inside, and this makes her feel very much alone. I know how she feels. But that itself is not unusual. I am the author, after all. I'm supposed to know how the character feels. It wasn't until I started gathering feedback that I realized how common this feeling is. I've had person after person tell me that they empathize with Ari, that they know where she's coming from. I didn't expect that. I cannot help but wonder how many of us walk through our lives day after day feeling slightly broken and alone, surrounded all the time by others who feel exactly the same way. So, if you listened to this book and you didn't enjoy it, I'm sorry. It's my fault. This is a strange story. You might enjoy it more the second time you hear it. Most of my stories are better the second time around. But then again, maybe not. If you're one of the people who found this story disconcerting, off-putting, or confusing, I apologize. The truth is, it probably just wasn't for you. The good news is that there are many other stories out there that are written just for you, stories you will enjoy much more. This story is for all the slightly broken people out there. I am one of you. You are not alone. You are all beautiful to me. Pat Rothfuss, June 2014. This is Patrick Rothfuss. I hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Slow Regard of Silent Things. This program was directed by Rick Harris, executive producer Karen Jakonski. The Slow Regard of Silent Things is a production of Penguin Random House Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2014. Text copyright 2014 by Patrick Rothfuss. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.